Welcome to another episode of The Shift with Elena Agard. In this episode, I chat with Rhett Roberts. He's the co-founder and CEO at Loan Pro. He has a lot of experience as just honestly being a serial entrepreneur in the world of fintech, which is not a world I know a lot about, but it was an interesting conversation. So definitely lots of learning for me in this chat, because as you guys know, it's not an area I focus on, but this was quite interesting to me from an entrepreneurial perspective. So really, he has a lot of experience in this field. And we talked a lot about kind of just the complexities of relationships between education and success, especially like if you want to be an entrepreneur, what does that look like, right? Is formal degree the only way to making it big? We also looked into just some of the fintech and some of the, you know, the themes around Bitcoin and all those things. And like, what does that even mean for me? Obviously, I'm not in that world. If I don't understand it, I can't be in it type thing. We talked about blockchain technology, really kind of demystifying its role in ownership custody and how this groundbreaking tech challenges traditional concept like sales tax on luxury items, for example. So we also dive into skepticism around government intervention in cryptocurrency, despite its potential to revolutionize industries. So really just talking a lot about, you know, curiosity as well and resilience as you build a business and so on. And in addition to that, he's also a father of four kids, huge on outdoor adventure, competitive swimmer, did 20 plus sprint triathlons. So very impressive individual, lots of energy, you know, really accomplished. So I think you'll enjoy this discussion, especially if you want to learn about entrepreneurship or fintech or blockchain and those sort of things and how to balance it all with having a family and four kids and just being a hustler. This conversation is for you. Enjoy.
Rhett, welcome to the podcast.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So for my audience, give us a little bit of a snapshot of all the amazing things that you've done, but really kind of, you know, a little overview of what brought you to what you're doing today with Loan Pro, and just the world that you live in.
Well, yeah, I bet. We've been active and have a lot of different things that are going on. So just a couple minutes of our genesis story of what we do. I did my education in investment finance. Excuse me. And out of school, it was about the same time I got married. And the intent was I always wanted to be a fund manager. Even as a little kid, I loved the concepts of anything to do with money management. And I'd always anticipated going on Wall Street and doing the asset management route. And about that time, I was just kind of questioning, is this the lifestyle I really want to do? And I'd always been intrigued by entrepreneurship. Started a whole series of businesses as a kid. Probably my earliest years, I think I was probably 14, 15 years old. I went to a shooting range and they had I noticed all the discarded shells at a shooting range. Mm-hmm. And I asked the folks at the shooting range, hey, what do you do with all of these? And they're basically trash for them. So I went home and out of my parents' shed, I built a machine with I think it's a half horsepower motor and a conveyor belt and a magnet and all these things. I built that you could sort and filter out by shoveling into these bins, and it would spin and discard the rocks and the dirt and wash it and clean and get rid of the steel and things. But we were essentially able to recycle a large amount of dirty brass from these different shells and made a bunch of money as a kid. So just always looking for an opportunity that might be, and that just intrigued me a lot. So fast forward a number of years, I got out of university, studied investment finance. And I joined my two brothers, and we didn't have any money, right? It was like, hey, what do you want to do? What's the process? So we started a car dealership, didn't know what we were doing there. And we started seeing things in the car dealership that we were like, hey, why does it work that way? And we'd go ask friends in the ecosystem, and their answers were, I don't know, that's just the way we do it. And so we just started like keeping a list of all these things that we thought worked a little bit wonky, and maybe it shouldn't be that way. And as we scaled our car dealerships, we had a few of them, service center, a couple locations, we learned we could get our customers financing, therefore sell more cars if we could support their financing options. Now, this is, you know, 15 plus years ago, 15 to 20 years ago. And at that time, there was prime and subprime auto financing and almost no man's land in the middle. And so if you had like really good credit, you could go get like a super low interest rate of credit union. And if you didn't, you'd get a really high interest rate at a subprime auto lender. And we just thought, you know, there's a lot of nuance in between. What if we started doing financing for our customers in between? So what now is kind of commonplace of a related finance company, and that's what we started, and that led us to lending, and we fell in love. And from the lending side, we scaled our auto loan business, and we ran into a new problem, and that was that the software to manage our own portfolio of loans had challenges being compliant and challenges doing the math the right way. And it wasn't very modern technology, and it didn't allow for like personalizations that were needed. So we built an internal tool to our own lending company. And what was that internal tool, fast forward all those years, is now what LoanPro is today. We provide what was an internal tool for ourselves. We provide that for really banks, credit unions, lenders of every shape and size. We provide that to them today. So kind of a long journey, but the piece I wanted to highlight is I didn't come out of school thinking, oh, I'm going to run a software business that manages loans, right? It was this innovation out of necessity, step by step, that you find an opportunity, find a need, and then you pivot and adjust. And there's many that have spoken about that on your podcast and others in the past, but I think I wanted to highlight that piece because so many people, I talked to a lot of young people today, and they think like, oh, I don't know what I want to do. And they think that's a problem. And the reality is nobody knows exactly what they want to do. You have to pivot and adjust a little bit over time.
That's an excellent point. I think with entrepreneurship becoming so trendy these days on university campuses, and even for even students who are graduating high school, and I think there's this want and need to, pursue entrepreneurship, and a lot of people don't distinguish one, in my opinion, between entrepreneurship and then just running a business, right? So like there's a difference, and I'm curious your thoughts on that, but also this idea that it has to be perfect, because it doesn't, it will never be perfect. I had a business in 2019. We held it for about 3.5 years. I've learned a lot of hard lessons at that time. Definitely want to start something again. But it's probably, I always say, like, just start it, because it's probably one of the best lessons to, just for the sake of the experience, to your point, because I think it's hard to understand that, especially as a young person, like maybe coming out of school, and you have these big dreams and ideas, and it's not even the skill, it's the resilience that gets you through it. And I'm curious in your experience, because we always say that there's like this something internal about people that go into these fields. So as you were growing up as a kid, what was it? I don't know, like, where do you feel this hunger for curiosity and this need to create come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. I like the word curiosity a lot. We actually sponsored a scholarship for one of the universities here. And when you are the sponsor of a scholarship, you get to pick the criteria of who qualifies for it. And then the university supports like folks who apply for it and the assessment so far that we're not involved in the assessment. But then I picked something that when they said, that's all you want to do. And I said, yep, the thing I want to check to see, I don't care if they come from a family has money or not. I don't care if it's the first time they're at university or not, or what their grades are. I want to give a scholarship to people who are curious because I think curiosity is the most highly coupled attribute with changing the world to be a better place. If you're just curious about things, regardless, it can be an engineering thing, how something works, it can be how relationships, then the curiosity is going to have you be very active in pursuing and trying to discover and improve how the world works. So I grew up in a family. I'm the youngest of eight kids, a large family. And my dad's an engineer. And my mom stayed home with us and all the jobs associated with running a crazy family of everything in that way. And we were pretty active. We did, of course, we had the normal sports things and we had some successes in a few sports and did real well in a few of those other areas. But my family really encouraged us to, I'll use that word again, of being curious, of go out. And we didn't really have a super high safety net. Like it wasn't a problem if you tried something and you failed. as long as you did kind of like as you brought up, you used the feedback loop of learning something. So failure is often viewed as like, hey, I tried something and it didn't work and I'm no good. Well, the reality is like a piece of that didn't work for macroeconomic reasons. Maybe you made some bad decisions. Maybe something's wrong in the structure. So what is it that didn't work and why? What was wrong with your hypothesis? So we essentially just grew up in a family where we tried a bunch of stuff. My parents started and failed on a couple businesses. My dad had a job for like stability for the family and, to get like insurance and things like that. But they tried a few different things and encouraged us to do the same. And that's kind of worked. It was important in our family. I founded this business that we run today with two of my brothers. And I like to tease, I've never really had a real job because we did this right out of university. And we've gone through and been doing that for approaching 20 years. But I have another brother that runs a charity that we started. And he got his PhD in economics, right? And the efforts that are involved in pursuing that. And so I think education is super important, but education can be a formal education, which I encourage, but you also get education by doing and trying things and this exploratory or an expert experiential learning model seems to be something that resonates with folks a lot. Go out and try stuff and do it from a framework of learning.
I know, so you have four kids. Do you tend to embed similar kind of curiosity lessons with your kids as well? I don't know how old they are, but maybe they're still little, but I'm curious how you apply this in your life as well.
Yeah, I sure hope so. It's something where my wife and I are trying to do very much so. Our oldest is 15 here in Utah. That means he just got his learner's permit to and we're having a lot of fun with that. He's actually a really good driver. He's doing great. But he and his younger brother and their friends have actually they're big into mountain biking, and so out on mountain biking these long opportunities where folks want to go camping from a mountain bike, like back into the woods, wherever they built and they're designing. The friend's parents own a manufacturing organization, and so with the carbon fiber and a few other things. So these kids have been busy the last number of months, and they've designed and engineered and done the CAD designs, and are now actually building and making all of these trailers that affix to the back of bikes. And building out a website and a marketing plan and going to these different shows and different biking competitions and learning how to talk to people and figure out what is your pricing and how do you talk about the skills and attributes of what your bike trailer is going to be. And then the feedback loop of what you hear from your customers or potential customers and should you modify your product one way or another. So it's been really interesting. He's doing that at 15. My other son that's involved is also 14. And so I think so. I think we're trying things that they see an opportunity and try it and learn things.
It's pretty interesting. It's something I really enjoy learning about is to understand, what is it that happens in our childhood that kind of creates, that need to kind of achieve and succeed and try things and build that resilience, right? Because I feel like there's a lot of talk about that, like especially in the corporate world, we're always looking for talent that knows how to manage change, that knows how to be resilient and be curious and creative and produce versus consume, consume, consume. So it's and I think there's something to how people grow up, absolutely. Go ahead.
Is up there like I find myself talking to a lot of people as well, and there seems to be some similar trends of things in their childhood. And you can read a whole bunch of books on this topic of things, but I have a friend of mine who's been wildly successful who was as a child as a refugee and grew up in Iran, family got ousted, moved over to France, then grew up most of his years in Germany. Got a scholarship to university here in the States. And he had this like really unpredictable childhood and like this lack of stability and move and had a, and he now knows five languages, but not necessarily chose on purpose. He wanted to learn them up front. His family had to learn them, move these different places. And that's not an uncommon story. When you find someone who's been successful, they have, I'll call it a unpredictable childhood. It wasn't necessarily a good or a bad one. It was just didn't have the same structure of what we call like the American family model. It was one where they had to identify opportunities and learn skills and abilities, be very agile and develop the, and having a high level of agility happens to be a similar way of how you win in a capitalistic environment. So be careful to say it's not a good or a bad on the child at least. It's just you potentially in that environment, you develop skill sets that happen to be skill sets that capitalism pays a lot of money for.
I want to go back to something you mentioned as well. You were talking, you were like, I really encourage formal education. And I want to get into the fintech piece in just a moment, but because you mentioned this and it's something that's fresh on my mind, because I don't know if you saw recently, I'm curious what you think as a parent, as somebody who is an entrepreneur, as somebody who's doing, you know, fintech kind of work and really creating, really kind of just keeping up with innovation and things like that. You mentioned, I really encourage formal education. So there was a report that recently came out and it talks about AI and who's the which jobs are most impacted by AI. I don't know if you saw it. And it talks about how bachelor degree holders will be the most impacted. So like 27% or 26, I forget exactly, compared to like high school graduate who just, you know, it's only 3%. That's because, you know, they tend to, you know, a lot of the trade kind of jobs, a lot of the blue collar kind of jobs. I'm curious what you think about it, because I felt like it was a strong point you mentioned. I was like, I just want to hear from you.
Yeah. So what did I learn in university? I have particular pieces of information I learned, but we're in the financial and technology space of the business we run, and the half-life of what is true changes pretty quick, right? Mm-hmm. Technologies change. So if I only knew what I learned in university, it would be obsolete for the most part, and it like specific pieces of information at this point in the game. But more than anything, I learned how to learn. I learned the framework about how to approach something that you don't know, mm-hmm. and you don't even know where to get started. And it provided this opportunity to go about this being curious and learn and what to do with the things that you learn. So it sounds really, really basic, but I didn't get it till university. Mm-hmm. And my experience is that's cool. You learned something. Now what are you going to do with it? Mm-hmm. And when I got to university, I figured that out. Like, oh, I have a feedback loop of information on something, and now I know what to do with that. So mm-hmm. I also statistically, it's definitely a useful thing to go get an education. Now, a piece I want to highlight that there's been a lot of speak about it. If you look at, you know, the number of billionaires and did they finish university and so forth, there's a very interesting sample set selection that occurs with that. And a disproportionate amount of money is made when you start a company earlier and capture the inflection point of when technology and that industry is really catching up, right? That kind of distorts those numbers a little bit. But for the broad stroke of organization, of individuals rather, getting a formal education increases your earning potential, increases your capacity, and most importantly, increases what you can give back to this world. And so instead of what's in it for me, if I get an education, I can be more for us. And so I think that's a really important perspective, is we're all on this ship together, and I want all of you to get an education, and I think you should expect that of me as well, so we can all lift this tide together. And so part of it's like, how can I benefit? But a large portion of it is how can I become the person I need to be to give back to this world in a way? And so education is super important with that. Now, a lot of folks conflate education with money or success. That is less clear if they're directly connected, mm-hmm. right? There's lots of success that happens that's not tied to getting a degree, a piece of paper that says you know something. Right. There's also other ways to learn stuff. You don't have to go get a piece of paper to say, I know something. There's all kinds of ways. And with the advance of technology, there's maybe even better ways to learn things. But it doesn't discount the concept that education is very important.
Yeah, no, you bring up a good point. And yeah, I think it's like when we look at all these kind of, the 1% of people who make it without education, but the reality is that the kind of everybody who's like a mediocre when it comes to their, I don't know if it's IQ or IQ, EQ, all of those things, they probably will succeed much better with a degree versus not, because the other route tends to be a little bit harder, and it's not for everybody. So even the blue collar jobs, it's not for everybody, right? The entrepreneurship, definitely not for everybody, right? So I think that it just kind of it's still the safer way to go. And I mean, we can have a whole other discussion about that at some point. So I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but it is something that's on top of my mind these days. I want to shift gears to a topic I know nothing about, which is cryptocurrency, blockchain technology. And, I know you sit on different fintech committees. I'm just curious, how have you seen just these two things gain traction? Do you see any technologies impacting the future of finance? Is there anything that you guys are doing to incorporate some of these platforms at LoanPro?
Great questions. Let me bifurcate blockchain from cryptocurrencies. For anyone listening, the blockchain side of things is a technology that does a distributed ledger that can prove like something like custody of ownership. And so if you wanted to move money, you could do it via blockchain technology. And what I mean by that is the ledger that records where the money's flowing is something that's in a distributed ledger so that you can't fake it or hack it or change it anyway. And so that technology is super solid, and there's many applicable uses for it. One that folks have used has been to do a cryptocurrency and go ahead and say, hey, let's do that moving money like that, and let's go ahead and issue a currency and move the money on that distributed ledger. And that at one point, so the software and business that we run provides the operating system to lenders of all different shapes and sizes. Sometimes they're companies, the banks, their credit unions, their non-traditional financial institutions, their hedge funds, their family offices, a variety of different lenders, and they give loans to different organizations, different people with different areas of specialty. So there might be somebody who gives a loan to a business for working capital, or it might be somebody who issues a credit card. And the cohort of who they issue to a card is a certain segment, or maybe they do student loans, maybe they do personal loans or auto loans or mortgages and so forth. You kind of get the idea. I'll call them the entire span and flavor of loans. At one point, before cryptocurrency had some challenges, we had about 4% of our revenue coming from cryptocurrency loans. So we're not the balance sheet on any of these, we're the technology they use to give the loans. And so I got pretty interested as that was a growing percentage that I did a deep dive to try to understand it. So I went out to a bunch of different conferences. I'll call some of them. I attended conferences of quote true believers, and I learned a lot, right? It was really interesting. My stance might be a little bit controversial, but my stance is that I don't put any of my personal money in cryptocurrency. And the reason for it is I think the technology is amazing. I think it's the wrong use case for it. And the thought process behind that is I don't believe that the central bank, and here the Fed, is going to cede control of the money supply. I just don't think they're going to let that be a thing. And so I don't know that I want to put my money in a place that evaporates with a signature of the government to go ahead and say, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Now, it has worked in other areas where they're not the US dollar, right? There have been some governments that essentially said, hey, let's do this. And it's because they've pegged the dollar and they're trying to unpeg and they're trying to move to a different model. And the volatility of cryptocurrency was less volatile than their currency. So, but it's a challenge. Now, the technology itself is golden. There's going to be a lot of use cases for it. I do think we get to a distributed ledger blockchain technology, and I do think we end up having an electronic currency that's backed by it from the US government. So it's a nuance that I want to highlight. like one that I think would be not controversial at all is custody of ownership through blockchain. So something like when you buy a house, why do you have to go to a title company? Right? You should be able to say, oh, the entry in the ledger before proves that it's owned, and these are the liens that are encumbering it. And in order to release it to move ownership, that should be a blockchain thing. And there's a lot of stuff that could do that. Then there's a long list of different industries that could deal with custody of ownership and this history to show, yes, now that thing's mine. I have a friend that did it. It's interesting. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but in a discovery effort, I tried to learn everything I could about blockchain. And his generally here in the United States, in almost everywhere, they don't charge sales tax on financial instruments, right? So if you buy and sell a stock, there's no sales tax. But you buy and sell shoes, there's probably sales tax in that transaction. And so because the laws are all written that way and laws are generally back facing based off of history, they're not always up to date with how things are changing going forward. So I met somebody, I'm not really friends, but we like connected. I got to understand his business model. And what his strategy was to take luxury items, issue a currency on blockchain. And what they would do is they would say the token that you have represents ownership of an item. And then they inserted themselves and said, any luxury items, I will play custodian as a middleman. So give me your luxury watch and I'll put it in my warehouse and I will return to you a token that represents you are the owner of that watch. Now you can go out into the world and sell that token to someone else, and then that person can show up to me to collect their watch because they proved with the token that they are the owner, and I give them the watch. And I'll charge you like a fee to warehouse the watch or the art or the car or whatever. And when person A sells the token to person B, it was a non-sales taxable transaction. It's a financial transaction. And so you're able to change ownership on anything that didn't need to be registered. And so, like a car, you have to go to the DMV and register. But a watch, then, so this essentially is a legal loophole on sales tax. Well, some governments are like, hey, we're not cool with that because our model, like, that's going to hurt the revenue. So they've started to like figure ways to address that. So it's very interesting what modernization happens in technology, what people get creative and they try things. So I think we're still in the very early innings to see what happens.
I give a lot of credit to people who actually, don't feel afraid to like go down that route and invest in it, because it's at the end of the day, like you have to believe that the token is worth something. Like it's just a concept, right? From what I understand, it's like you have to believe in it. It's like I can't imagine taking a token. Like it would have to be such a widespread thing for somebody like me who knows nothing about it, and I tend not to invest things I know nothing about. Right? Like that's like the worst thing to do. And I would just be very like confused about using anything like that. So I don't know, maybe I'm just a dinosaur when it comes to those things.
Obviously, they have some pretty compelling arguments. The best
Right.
argument they have is the limited amount of cryptocurrency, and so it will grow because we're not continuing, like the US government just prints more money, right? So their best argument is to say, hey, you can hedge against that because the distributed ledger simply has this ecosystem and that's it. There's no So deflation and inflation, the controls are much more transparent. It's a pretty compelling argument. My rebuttal to that is, yes, you're right, but do you really think the US government's going to give up that control?
Or if they take control and like furthermore, and then we're going into a whole other set of problems and issues. So,
Right.
Interesting. Definitely something, it's nothing I know about, sadly, and something that I definitely want to learn more about. But I'm curious in your experience and just in compliance and consumer lending, B2B lending in particular, in software development, what do you think are the key drivers that are going to be driving success in the fintech sector in general today in particular?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we have a couple of bets that we're making based off of like trends and some what we feel is pretty strong data-informed decisions. We think first that the compliance of tomorrow is more complicated than it was of yesterday. And so compliance is a, we call it compliance as a strategy. And years ago, we were sort of like, people would laugh about that. Like, no, you have to be compliant. We're like, no, you really need it as your core strategy. And what I mean by that is, if you're building the software to manage money, that's a pretty intimate experience with people and their money. If you logged into your bank to see your money and it's like not there, or it's the wrong numbers, or it's not working, then you begin to lose confidence in that particular bank or in the experience and relationship you have. So it's a very low tolerance for there to be a problem. And it's part of the reason why there's been delayed core innovation in this space is because of risk mitigation strategies of how to modernize and do it in a way that's compliant and that doesn't diminish any trust or faith in the institutions. And so the first step is really is a compliance and this huge focus on compliance. There's various different levels. I'll give the analogy I often repeat is in elementary school, we would have, you know, your desks are sitting there and typically in the middle of the room, there would be a desk with an overhead projector on it. And they would pull the screen down and dim the lights and you'd have something projected. I don't know if everyone's old enough as me to remember.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know if some audience, they're going to be like, what are you talking about? But yes,
and
I'm
so
with
there's
you.
This overhead projection.
Yeah.
And you'd put something on the glass and it would project up on the wall. And typically they were like transparent papers with different shapes or whatever on them. And you could write on it and everybody could see what was happening. Well, I did this visual of imagine each sheet is a layer of compliance. You have the OCC and the FDIC and the alphabet of these different federal regulating kind of compliance layers, the CFPB and so forth. It says, this is how you have to do things. If that's how you give a loan or how you decision or how you collect or what you do in a servicing action and so forth, they have rules and an opinion about that. And they're all well-intended. They're all like, hey, we need to make it fair. We need to make access to credit not discriminatory. We need to, you know, like they set the rules of how you engage, but now it's up to people who are playing the game to make sure they follow the rules. Well, it gets kind of complicated because not all of them play nice with each other. Some of them conflate one another. Some of them compete with one another. What takes priority? And so this visual of an overhead, you kind of put one paper down and then the next one, and you layer these and the shapes are slightly different. So sort of like a simple Venn diagram of the smallest area, but they might be weird shapes, not just circles. And that's what we've built within our platform, this rule-based logic of compliance. Because compliance isn't just government rules. It might be federal or state, but it also might be rules that come from an investor or a credit facility or strings that are attached to money. And like, let me give one example. If there's a hedge fund, there's many of them that do this, that their policies are, you can use my money. So here's like a giant pile of money, a couple hundred million dollars, and you give loans that look like X. And it's a personal loan to a certain FICO score or risk parameter of a customer and so forth. They approve that range and they say, I want to have regular reports to see how the portfolio is doing. Are people making their payments on time? How much interest are we accruing? What late fees are happening and so forth? Well, they have to come to some standards of what does it mean to make a payment on time? Well, it's not always just you pay exactly the due amount on the due date. Some of these credit facilities or hedge funds, they write, you know, what was the intent? If the borrower makes 97% of the minimum due, then you should advance their next due date. So if you might have a $100 payment And if you pay $90, you're $10 past due and you're delinquent. But if you pay $97, yes, you're still $3 delinquent, but we're just going to roll that to the back of the loan and say you're not delinquent anymore. So you got to build these kinds of systems that allow for business rules and regulation rules and stuff to layer in. So compliance is a really big play. Optimization, as we see the trends in financial services and things, a lot of it requires a lot of humans. And we think there's some opportunity for some efficiencies there to automate people's compliance, to automate engagements. You talked about some modernization of technologies. Think of a AI or a large language model where you can do it today on Amazon and many others. If you want to return an item on Amazon, you're not talking to a human. You're going to be like texting or emailing them. And in the instant message thing, it's going to pop up and it's going to feel like you're talking to a human who knows who you are and what you ordered and what you want to do. And but that's all AI. In the same way, we are building and working with a number of our customers to do the same thing on how do you service and manage your loans. So that allows for a 24/7, doesn't matter where you're located, you can talk to somebody in your language that will be aware of you and your performance on your loan, aware of the company's policies. Are you allowed to do this thing or not? And you could use them in straightforward language of like, hey, can I change a due date? Well, maybe the language of the bank doesn't use that word. Maybe they're like, skip a payment or defer a payment or forbearance or these things that maybe you don't know the vocabulary of. And the large language models are smart enough to figure that out, map it, and do those activities. So those are some of the things that are happening. I think it's a very, very bright future. There's a modernization strategy. Basically, every financial institution that exists has publicly announced that they're trying to modernize their back office, their technology. If that's an app or a customer experience or a website or those things, part of it's because of cost and efficiencies they're trying to get. And the final one we really play on is personalization. To give an example of personalization, we released something called transaction level credit that allows you to charge on a credit card where the back office imagines everything on a card. You could charge a different interest rate or a unique interest rate per transaction based off of attribution defined at the program level. So you could say, like a really simple program, it could be gasoline is 1% interest and groceries are zero, but everything else is the 15%. And it gives for a high level of specialization, and it allows for basically anything that you could do today in a rewards program, pull that forward into the financial instrument itself. And it allows you to highly personalize cards, co-brands, and so forth in a way that really meets your customer where they're at, and you understand their needs and their use cases there. We got another client of ours who does loans for teachers, and some districts in the United States have diminished pay during the summer break, and some do like pay throughout the whole year equal and average it out. Others say, hey, summer break, we're going to have a lull in the payment. So if you give a loan to somebody, say like an auto loan to somebody, and you know that their employment, they get paid less during the summer, and you just do a straight line amortized loan, when they have a hard time paying in the summer, I mean, that was kind of obvious, right? You like knew that was going to happen. And many folks approach that with like, oh, they'll figure it out. It's their problem. They'll figure it out. Well, we think there's a better way, and we have a number of customers we've engaged with to do so, where they say, okay, well, why do we want it to be a straight line amortized loan? Typically, it's not because of what the borrower wants. Typically, it's because where the money's coming from wants that. The investor wants that, or the capital markets where the money's coming from wants a straight line amortized loan. So if you can figure out that side of it, and there's a number of models I won't go into right now to support it. Well, it turns out a highly personalized loan for a teacher that diminishes payments during the summer and then normalizes again is more performant than its counterpart that's straight line amortized against the same risk class of a customer. So it's sort of common sense that requires a lot of like effort and work to create these things because the ecosystem's not designed that way. And so that's a big effort we see to your question of how do we see things happening in finance. It's really those compliance, optimization, modernization, and personalization that we think will be the drivers.
That's super interesting, and it tends to be very similar kind of pillars across so many different things, because that's where everybody's going for, right? Optimization, modernization, personalization, right? The compliance, and depending on the sector, but the other three are pretty relevant in a lot of different areas. I'm curious, being running this business, being a father for a husband, sitting on different committees, how do you manage all of that?
Yeah, it's fun. So I started this business with two of my brothers, and this last year, both of them take a passive role in LoanPro, and one's actively running investments and family office stuff that we do, and others helping out with a charity we run called Become More, and I'm still running things here at LoanPro. So our partnership essentially like expanded, and we're like a divide conquer strategy. And so the first, we are busy. There's a lot of things going on. We feel this big need to try to make the world a better place. And the word I want to use is impact. What's the impact I can have on this world? And that starts first, like, you draw rings or circles. That's first, what's the impact in my marriage? What's the impact with my kids and the impact with my broader family? And you do these rings out of your sphere of influence. And we feel very fortunate to be in a position where the technology and business that we built has maximum levered impact, where we can control and manage the tools of the people who control the money. And it gives us this huge impact to actually change how the world works, how finance work the way that it ought to. And so that's the big motivator and driver. So your question about like time management and how do you load these things, I think it needs to start with the why. Why are you doing this? And it always, for me at least, it started with a focus on personal financial freedom, right? That's a pretty big driver. There was definitely a period of time there where, I would work 6 days a week, 16 hours a day. That's approaching 100 hours a week. And I didn't know where the money was going to come from to pay for food next week, right? Have health insurance and so forth. So like I think the drivers can change a little bit over time. At that time, the driver is, well, I have a responsibility and I need to provide for my family. And then as we've been blessed and fortunate to have financial success, the motivation needs to change a little bit. And that motivation for me is having the opportunity to really improve the ecosystem and change the world of how finance works. And that provides the driver, but it still requires long hours. It still requires prioritization. The best key that I can share on that one is have good people around you, and to organize in such a way that you know what you're good at and you're self-aware of maybe what you're not so good at, and you have a strategy. How do you augment what you're not so good at? Either you need to get good at it, or you need somebody who is that you trust that's with you in this journey. So, there's lots of people who say these sayings, this concept, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And it's the strategy of how do you design that together. So it's the team. I'm a swimmer for exercise. And so I love swimming, sort of like my time to meditate and think. You get in the pool, all your distractions go away. People get the same thing with running, like trail running or something, where I can just think on a problem and study. I also find one of the most efficient things for me is when I have a notepad next to my bed, and I take like 5 minutes to read my most challenging things that I don't know how to do or what the big problem is before I go to sleep. And there's lots of books on this topic. But have your subconscious help you figure that out while you're sleeping. And I would say at least 2 days a week, I wake up with some idea of a thread to go down of how to address that. And so just organizing yourself in a way, it's not just a matter of like brute force it all of the time. It's a matter of having the right support structure around you. Importantly, having the right motivators of why. Why are you doing this? And that gives you the motivation to proceed and to go there. And then building the ecosystem around you in that support system that is aligned, that you're trying to achieve the same thing together. So sorry, it's kind of a long answer to it, but
I know it's beautiful, very practical, very, very practical. My mother is a swimmer, and so is my brother. My mom used to be a swim coach, so I grew up with, and she still swims to this day every week. So
I try to follow every morning. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Before I ask you my last question, where can people get in touch with you or connect with Loan Pro or just connect with you as an individual?
Yeah, awesome. Just as an individual, you can hit me up on LinkedIn. If we can help you as a business, or if you're in the anything in the lane of loans of any kind, if it's a credit card or an auto loan, a personal loan, or merchant cash advance, you name it, any flavor of loan, our website is loanpro.io and view us as the operating system to manage loans.
Beautiful. I'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well for those that are listening. And last question I ask all of my guests is, what is one question you wish people would ask themselves more often?
There's a book that I read by D. Hawk that is he's the founder of Visa. And this concept has stuck with me for a long time, for years since I read it, of design. So the question would be like, how can I design for how it ought to be and then work back to reality? And I think a lot of time we spend so much energy in this life understanding the history lesson of why something is the way that it is, we don't really spend enough time focusing how ought it to be.
I love that. Rhett, thank you so much for being on The Shift. And we hope to talk to you again. I'm sure my audience will have some questions, so I'll make sure to pass those along in the comments when I get those. But thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, and congratulations on all your success, and we're excited about the show.